You know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout, throw my hands up and shout, throw my head back and shout. Come on now, don't forget to say you will. Don't forget to say yeah, 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 yeah.
Say you will.
Say it right now, baby.
Say you will.
Come on, come on.
Say you will.
Say it better.
Say you will.
Come on now. Say that you love me. Say that you need me. Say that you want me. You want
live
me.
From New York City, it's The Gary Knowles Show. And now, your host, Gary Knowles.
I still remember when you used to be now.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knowles, and we have a lot to share today. Of course, the latest on health and healing. Then we have an audio clip that I just saw this morning, and I was so intrigued by it that we did some independent evaluation and found that it's not just accurate, but it's here now. It's the self-assembling computer chips. They're saying of the future, but they already have the technology. So then I'm going to follow that with a Wired Noam Cohen commentary on Zuckerberg wants Facebook to build a mind-reading machine. And then from Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, Matt Field, concerned about facial recognition, artificial intelligence. What about behavioral recognition software? They wouldn't be giving us all of these heads up if they weren't about to launch a public relations program to show us all the virtues and benefits of it. Well, I'm sure there are some virtues and benefits for them. I don't know about you and I. We'll have a commentary on that. I will be taking some calls, depending upon how long it takes to answer the calls. And then the wall, the Mexican wall. Louis Black, the comedian, has something to say about it. And Mary Holland, a professor at law at the New York University, is at the United Nations. And I'm going to give you part one of what she has to say. I think you'll find it of interest. That's our program, a lot to share. And it starts with a study that finds that celery may halt breast cancer. This is from the University of Missouri. Now, most people, when they think of celery, they think, well, if you're overweight, you eat celery because it has low calories and lots of fiber. Yeah, but there's a lot more to celery than that. In fact, University of Missouri researchers found that it could also be the next non-toxic treatment to stop invasive breast cancer in its tracks. According to the university, every day more than 100 American women die from breast cancer. In fact, GreenMedInfo reported that it's the most commonly diagnosed cancer and the second leading cause of cancer-related deaths in women. But there is hope to beat the disease, and it's coming from a flavonoid molecule named lutein, L-U-T-E-O-L-I-N, and that's found in celery. Now, women who have gone through their menopause often resort to synthetic hormone replacement therapy. I'm opposed to that. Natural bioidentical hormones, that will work. But when you're trying to replace the hormones the body no longer makes in insufficient amounts, you're playing Russian roulette. There's a form of biochemical alchemy, and there's rarely a good outcome. Why? Because when these hormones like progestin, a synthetic form of the natural hormone progesterone, given to women to prevent endometrial cancer, there's no long-term studies done on its relationship to cancer. And though it may prevent one type of cancer, a study found that the synthetic human growth hormone significantly increased a woman's risk of breast cancer and heart disease and stroke and blood clots in the veins and blood clots in the lungs and dementia and colorectal cancer. So thanks to the study's findings, the use of synthetic hormone replacement therapy has dropped. Now, about 10 million women have been using it every day, and there's a minimum of 13 5% adverse effect, or 1.3 million women every day put their lives at stake by taking the synthetic form of the natural hormone progesterone. So, well, let us hope that more and more women go towards a natural approach. And, of course, Dong Quai, Fo Tai, Vitex, there's so many really good ways of approaching postmenopausal rebalancing of your hormones. But this luteolin reduced what is called angiogenesis, or the formation of blood vessels that feed cancer cells, while increasing the rate of apoptosis, or programmed cell death. Now, next to its cancer-fighting abilities, luteolin also display protective effects. So that's really important. So I suggest having celery juice. That way you're getting all the nutrients that were locked into the celery, and that can help you. Because one of the things that you should be concerned about is that the research has found that luteolin can prevent breast cancer cells to turn into cancer stem cells. And just a little short thing on this, these stem cells enable cancer to take on a deadly form by speeding up tumor growth and promoting metastasis to lymph nodes and other parts of the body. So anything that can help women reduce cancer is a good thing. So it's just something simple and inexpensive. Something else that's simple and inexpensive is green tea. Ohio State University found that green tea cuts obesity and the health risks in this laboratory experiment. And why? Because, as you know, green tea is strongly anti-inflammatory. And we know that the more inflammatory biomarkers that you have, the poorer your health. So by having green tea each day, you're helping, according to the Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry that published this, you're helping to stem a lot of the biochemical problems, and you also have healthier microbes in the gut. So, and remember, everything that happens in your body is happening in no small measure in the gut. It's called the microbiome, microbiome, or you can just say the good bacteria. But the negative change is because of a negative diet, a diet rich in sugars and refined carbohydrates and meat and alcohol, that has previously been linked to obesity. And green tea has been shown to promote healthy bacteria. So green tea, for all the other things it does, now we can say that, yes, the catechins, C-A-T-E-C-H-I-N-S, these are very strong anti-inflammatory polyphenols. They're in green tea. And they've been linked to anti-cancer activity and a lower risk of heart disease and liver disease. So all this good comes just from having one or two glasses of green tea a day. Also, researchers find breathing in before doing a task might make you better at doing it. This is from the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel, published in Nature Human Behavior. What they found was that people sometimes do better on tasks if they inhale first. Now, sports fans have grown used to seeing athletes take a big breath before they execute a task, such as serving a tennis ball or carrying out a play on the gridiron. Now, that's all true. Others have likely done the same thing before embarking on a task themselves. I find that just breathing deeply, slowly, and rhythmically with stronger exhale before you start a race helps oxygenate the blood, making it easier also, and because you're superoxygenating the tissue. And so that's what they're finding. They find that, and don't do nasal breathing, meaning we've been led for the last probably 40 years to believe that yoga breathing is the best. It's not. That's just another myth. About 15% oxygenation comes through the nose, but 85% comes through the throat. And you need the throat breathing. So that's what's important. Now, comparing data from the Israeli studies, we have found that deep breathing and breathing in is important. So just try that. See if it does make a difference. Also, L-theanine is one of the best ways to combat stress, reduce your heart rate. Now, theanine is T-H-E-A-N-I-N-E. That means it's an amino acid. And it's in green tea also, but you can get it by itself. So Columbia University Irving Medical Center did the study. And we know that stress affects your body, both physically and mentally. And it can affect your sleep quality and even increase your risk of certain health conditions. So theanine, about 200 milligrams, can de-stress you and help you, and that's important. It can boost your cardiovascular health. In fact, researchers found that an amino acid, a theanine, helped reduce both stress levels and your heart rate in participants. Now, a lot of people have an irregular heartbeat, a lot. So this is one of the ways that we can help those people. That and L-carnitine, that makes a difference. And magnesium makes a difference as well. So decrease stress with theanine. It can make a big difference. Also, according to Rutgers University, published in the Journals of Gerontology, how much vitamin D you use can directly boost your learning and decision-making, especially if you're an older person. So that's important. So, again, the Rutgers-led team study found that overweight and obese older women who took more than three times the recommended daily dose of vitamin D showed improvements in memory and learning. So that's important. So a lot of people are not getting enough vitamin D. In fact, I'm writing an article. I started this morning, but it requires reading hundreds of scientific abstracts. And I just started with the vitamin D. And thus far, virtually all of the studies show that 85% of Americans are deficient, along with Canadians, in vitamin D. Now, when you realize how many good things vitamin D does in your body, helping your heart, preventing strokes, preventing cancer, building your immune system, helping you have stronger bones, and you're deficient in it, then all those things are working against you. So, more vitamin D can improve your memory. That's the takeaway message. And a lot of seniors are not getting their vitamin D. Also, from an Indian Institute of Chemical Technology comes a study that the oat extracts can protect against alcohol-induced liver damage. We have a lot of people who have alcohol liver damage. In fact, I was just finishing a study yesterday, reviewing studies. I was curious, how long are you shortening your life by drinking alcohol on a regular basis? And then you have to look at all the studies, and then it depends upon what age you began drinking and the type of alcohol and percentage of alcohol in a given drink. It's different than if it's a 2.3% beer alcohol versus a 11% wine versus a harder alcohol at 50 to 80% alcohol. Because the more alcohol you have as a percentage of that liquid, the greater damage it does to the brain, the liver, the kidneys, the heart, the eyes. And then how often do you drink? And how much do you drink? Is it 2 ounces, 6 ounces, 8 ounces? So you have to factor in all this, but at the end of it, even if you're a very mild drinker, it's about 3 years. If you're more of a regular drinker, it could be up over your lifetime. You're knocking 24 years off your lifespan. Let me repeat that. 24 years off your lifespan if you're a regular drinker, and a lot of people are. It contributes to cardiovascular disease, diabetes, gastrointestinal problems. So the oat extract can help protect you against acute liver injury. Now, they don't know why, but the extract from oats is very important. And it's not a big amount. It's only around 200 milligrams per kilogram a day for 12 consecutive days. That's not a high amount. So that's good. So again, that's something else that can help us. And by the way, from University of Sharjah in the United Arab Emirates, a species of hawthorn berry can be found to control abnormal high blood sugar levels. So for all the diabetics and pre-diabetics, that's good news. And this was published in the British Medical Journal Complementary and Alternative Medicine. And they identified the Crete hawthorn, C-R-E-T-E, and it's a plant native to the Mediterranean basin, and it's been known to have anti-hyperglycemic or high blood sugar properties. So it can help lower your blood glucose levels. That's a good thing. That's important. And then finally, smoking, high blood pressure, and diabetes linked to an unhealthy brain. From University of Edinburgh, and that's just another reason. And by the way, that also includes marijuana smoking. And again, I don't want to go through a whole soliloquy on why I support legalization of all drugs, but also with marijuana, and there's 22,000 scientific studies on the benefit of the cannabinoids. But that is different than the smoking of the marijuana, which has very known and devastating physiological effects. And a lot of people think, oh, marijuana is good for your brain, stops seizures, and helps you if you have autism, and yes, and a lot more. But that's the oil. If you're smoking it, you're also increasing the carcinogenicity of that going into your body. So all this ends up creating problems for our brain. In fact, there are 7 very specific vascular risk factors and differences in the structure of parts of the brain, and the strongest links were with areas of the brain known to be responsible for our complex thinking skills, and which deteriorate during the development of, let's say, inflammation of the brain like dementia, which one part of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. And the researchers looked at over 9,772 people examining MRI scans, and that's what they found. So just remember, when you have high blood pressure, when you're overweight, when you have diabetes, when you have elevated cholesterol, then you're going to end up damaging your brain. And you won't know it initially. Also, finally, from Natural Blaze, Immortality Herb boosts the cellular health so you feel younger longer. Many Japanese elders refer to the plant, and I'll spell it for you, Ashitaba, A-S-H-I-T-A-B-A, as the immortality plant, and believe it will keep you looking and feeling young. And for ages, people in Japan have been using this plant as a functional food or as a medicine to prevent illness. Now researchers are discovering why. A flavonoid substance in the Ashitaba may be responsible for boosting cellular health. It does so by helping the body clear out cellular debris and supporting the process of autophagy. And most parts of your body completely regenerate themselves many times during our lifetime. The last study I did on this was about 50 generational changes, and those should be about 2.5 years. So theoretically, we should be able to live 150 years. Well, no one's known that we can actually verify. There have been non-verifiable people living longer, but verified 116, 117 is about the longest. But that's after not having everything that goes into the formula of what extends life and what shortens life. But we do rejuvenate. And some cells, as for example the lining of the stomach, are completely new every few days. Other types of cells take longer. For example, bones take around 10 years to rejuvenate themselves. This means that every day the body has to clear itself of cellular debris in order to maintain cellular health. And scientists call this clearing process auto, A-U-T-O, phagy, P-H-A-G-Y. And this process rids the body of broken and disused and dead parts. And as a result, there is less likelihood that debris builds up and causes disease. And so this particular plant helps do that. So it's like a, what would I say, a Roto-Rooter? I'm clogging a sink or a toilet. And so the flavonoid is called 4-DD dimethyloxycholone. And, or let's just make it short and simple, DMC. And it's probably your single best age-related cell cleansing that we have. So, that's it. So now you have some stuff you didn't know, all from quality sources, and so you can be ahead of the curve. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to be back in a moment and go right into your first question. Please stay with us. Now, I'm going to play you a clip. This is a very important clip. I'm only going to play the first 5 minutes, so listen to this clip.
Computers used to be as big as a room, but now they fit in your pocket, on your wrist, and can even be implanted inside of your body. How cool is that? And this has been enabled by the miniaturization of transistors, which are the tiny switches in the circuits at the heart of our computers. And it's been achieved through decades of development and breakthroughs in science and engineering, and of billions of dollars of investment. But it's given us vast amounts of computing, huge amounts of memory, and the digital revolution that we all experience and enjoy today. But the bad news is we're about to hit a digital roadblock, as the rate of miniaturization of transistors is slowing down. And this is happening at exactly the same time as our innovation in software is continuing relentlessly with artificial intelligence and big data. And our devices regularly perform facial recognition or augment our reality or even drive cars down our treacherous, chaotic roads. It's amazing. But if we don't keep up with the appetite of our software, we could reach a point in the development of our technology where the things that we could do with software could in fact be limited by our hardware. And we've all experienced the frustration of an old smartphone or tablet grinding slowly to a halt over time under the ever-increasing weight of software updates and new features. And it worked just fine when we bought it not so long ago. But the hungry software engineers have eaten up all the hardware capacity over time. The semiconductor industry is very well aware of this and is working on all sorts of creative solutions, such as going beyond transistors to quantum computing, or even working with transistors in alternative architectures, such as neural networks, to make more robust and efficient circuits. But these approaches will take quite some time, and we're really looking for a much more immediate solution to this problem. The reason why the rate of miniaturization of transistors is slowing down is due to the ever-increasing complexity of the manufacturing process. The transistor used to be a big, bulky device until the invent of the integrated circuit based on pure crystalline silicon wafers. And after 50 years of continuous development, we can now achieve transistor features, dimensions, down to 10 nanometers. You can fit more than a billion transistors in a single square millimeter of silicon. And to put this into perspective, a human hair is 100 microns across. A red blood cell, which is essentially invisible, is 8 microns across, and you could place 12 across the width of a human hair. But a transistor, in comparison, is much smaller, at a tiny fraction of a micron across. And you could place more than 260 transistors across a single red blood cell, or more than 3,000 across the width of a human hair. It really is incredible nanotechnology in your pocket right now. And besides the obvious benefit of being able to place more smaller transistors on a chip, smaller transistors are faster switches, and smaller transistors are also more efficient switches. So this combination has given us lower cost, higher performance and higher efficiency electronics that we all enjoy today. To manufacture these integrated circuits, the transistors are built up layer by layer on a pure crystalline silicon wafer. And in an oversimplified sense, every tiny feature of the circuit is projected onto the surface of the silicon wafer and recorded in a light-sensitive material, and then etched through the light-sensitive material to leave the pattern in the underlying layers. And this process has been dramatically improved over the years to give the electronics performance we have today. But as the transistor features get smaller and smaller, we're really approaching the physical limitations of this manufacturing technique. The latest systems for doing this patterning have become so complex that they reportedly cost more than $100 million each. And semiconductor factories contain dozens of these machines. So people are seriously questioning, is this approach long-term viable? But we believe we can do this chip manufacturing in a totally different and much more cost-effective way. Using molecular engineering and mimicking nature down at the nanoscale dimensions of our transistors. As I said, the conventional manufacturing takes every tiny feature of the circuit and projects it onto the silicon. But if you look at the structure of an integrated circuit, the transistor arrays, many of the features are repeated millions of times. It's a highly periodic structure. So we want to take advantage of this periodicity in our alternative manufacturing technique. We want to use self-assembling materials to naturally form the periodic structures that we need for our transistors. We do this with the materials.
Okay, understand what he just said. And he is saying that now they have the technology where materials can construct themselves at levels where you can have thousands of these computers in less than the width of a single hair. They're there. This is from Wired, Noam Cohen. For those of us who worry that Facebook may have serious boundary issues when it comes to the personal information of its users, Mark Zuckerberg's recent comments at Harvard should get to the heart of this. Zuckerberg dropped by the university last month, ostensibly as part of a year of conversations with experts about the role of technology in society. Quote, the opportunities, the challenges, the hopes, and the anxieties he was talking about of the role of technology in society. And it was a two-hour interview, but he went on to talk about how Zuckerberg wants to build a mind-reading machine. Now, go to what I just said, or what this guy just said, on TED. And this is one of the leaders in the field, that they have brought it to a place where it can self-create. You can have millions upon hundreds of millions of messages in something less than the width of a hair. And now they want it to read your mind. And I can see how they would promote all this as being, you know, think of people who have anxiety and think of people who are uncertain about their life with this new technology. It would be so simple that all we would do is simply, you know, instill a simple chip so small you wouldn't even know it would be half that of a grain of sand. And you would have no idea what role it could play in your life. But nor do they, because remember, anything that they create with artificial intelligence can also control your behavior. It can control your body, it can control you, it can control anyone in society that it was a part of. And Matt Field, a Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, says, a young woman picks up and compares juices in a store aisle. She's 29. She spends 40 minutes on average shopping and likes orange juice. That's not all. She usually spends 2,500 yen per visit to the store. The Japanese startup VAX software knows a lot about the woman in the white shirt. Most importantly, it knows that there is only a 4% chance of her doing something such as shoplifting. VAC is one of the growing number of companies across the globe developing artificial-powered surveillance technology that analyzes body language to judge whether someone is behaving in a suspicious manner. But many companies envision the products as a security tool. So now, this just not your facial recognition, they're judging your behavior. So what if you decided to protest something? What if you decided that you went online and to write something? They're watching you when you're writing on the internet. They're studying your voice. They're studying your facial characteristics, your patterns. They're creating a profile on you. Wonder what they could do with a profile with someone like myself as a social activist and is not afraid to go up and tell the establishment what I think of them. Well, that would make me one of their public enemies, which I already am. But I'm saying, what about if you're the average person? You never go to a demonstration. You never wrote anything that would be considered threatening. Right now in China, this already exists. They are already shaming people. When you get on board a plane or subway or train, you have an app that you go to the app and it tells you everyone in your immediate car whether or not they're considered a good citizen or a bad citizen. And they don't tell you why, but if they have debt, they'll tell you they have debt, and that's not a good citizen. They're already shaming people, and therefore designating this is a person that you should not speak to. This is a person that is not worthy of our attention. That's happening right now as we speak in China. So you see, these people wouldn't have given us the information like this TED Talk unless they're now ready to go forward with this new point of transhumanism. By the way, not today, we're out of time, but an upcoming program, I'll tell you how far they've gone with transhumanism and why. The more information you share about yourself on Facebook, the more they're using that in their transhumanism programming. And now they want to read your mind? Wow. They wouldn't say they want to read your mind if they didn't have it already developed. They could read your mind. That's how it works. Now I'm going to address several important social issues. This is from Leo Girard from Common Dreams. And he says, of course, college admissions rigged for the rich. The whole economic system is. Just my own aside here, that I saw this about 25 years ago when there was a person who was having difficulty with their doctoral thesis, and at the Union Graduate School. And they'd been in there, I believe it was 12 years. It was one of the most difficult colleges in the America to get into, Union Institute, and it was one of the most difficult to get out. And I had gotten a multidisciplinary degree with 9 members to my doctoral panel, and some who were out and out hostile. So I could appreciate what this person was going through. And then he said, did you hear about this service where you can pay a fee, and it, I think he said $3,000, and the person will write your doctoral thesis for you? I said, but the point of a doctoral thesis is so that you can prove mastery of field. What are you contributing that's unique and original to the body of work that already exists to show that you deserve your doctorate? And I said, I don't believe you should do this, because if you open that door, every time there's an opportunity for you to do something by taking a shortcut, you're probably going to do it. Wouldn't it be better to go ahead and work with your faculty and the faculty dean and ask them, say, I'm having some challenges, could you help me? They're very willing to work with people here, and that was my suggestion. What he did, I don't know. But then I began to look around, and what I saw really bothered me. There were hundreds that I became aware of people willing, in just New York City, to write anyone's thesis, people willing to go in and take a test for you. Remember, a lot of the universities have a very large enrollment. And the teacher comes in, stands at the podium, there's a lecture, and then leaves. They don't really have, in most cases, a knowledge of the people sitting in that class. And so these were substitute students. That's what they call themselves. And again, for a fee, they would take your classes and even take your tests. So I saw back then, we're going back almost 30 years, people gaming this system. And that was at the college level. Then later it would end up at the high school level where people simply couldn't pass the test. And so they lowered the standards. And then they would give multiple choices, and they had all this going on. Plus, at that time, there were people spending large amounts of money to have their children coached. And so the student, who was not either able, didn't want to learn on their own, would have a person come in, depending upon the course they were having trouble with, and this person would coach them. And the parents would pay a fee. Generally, it was $100 an hour to be coached. And you might be coached 10, 15 hours a week. Well, think of the advantage that that gives someone. Imagine someone who's sitting there telling you how to take a test, how to answer questions, what the probable questions will be, and then all you're doing, you're going by what they say, and there's no critical learning process here. And that was at private schools and public schools. Private schools, where the elite were going, were caught up in cheating scandals on multiple occasions. And then you had the public schools. So we were failing our obligations and responsibilities, big time. So then I looked again at the colleges, and I remember we were doing some radio programs on this. Richard Gale and I began to look at the Ivy League schools versus the state universities versus trade schools versus the two-year schools with the lesser degrees, the associate degrees. And we saw that the people most likely to study hard were the people going to the trade schools because it was a craft. It was going to be their future. This wasn't a game to them. Frequently, they didn't want to go to college or they couldn't afford to. And so maybe they wanted to and couldn't get in. And so at least this gave them an opportunity to become a mechanic, electrician, a carpenter, a plumber, a mason, you know, someone who could actually go out and find work and good paying work. So the problem was not even at the state universities. The problem was at the private schools, and major scandals occurred at many of the Ivy League schools. But again, people thought it was a one-off. It was not. In fact, the last time I looked, which was about 3 years ago, a thesis, depending upon which school you were going to, could cost you up to $25,000 to have someone else do it. Well, you got to be very rich, come from a rich family, to be able to afford that. And then I'm only going to tell you from my perspective, as a person who has hired many people, some who graduated summa cum laude, magna cum laude, and quite frankly, when they started to do work, they were not living up at the work standard to what I had believed was their qualifications. And one guy in particular, he said he could do a project, but he had to work from home, and unfortunately, we let him go and do this. It cost us $80,000 to do a new design. What he turned in was so bad that our IT people were just appalled. And yet he had gone to a major school with a 4-point average, and he was one of the dimmest people I've ever met. So the question is, and a question I'll never know the answer, did he have someone cheat for him? You see, here's the problem. Everywhere in America, there's cheating going on at every level, in every institution. The people who cheat when it comes to telling us what's really in our water that comes out of the ground, you know, hydrofracking water. They cheat. They lie because it's to their advantage. Pharmaceutical companies are lying and cheating because they know that their medications frequently are not going to help people and are going to hurt people, but it's profitable. So they cheat. They lie. So we have institutional bias everywhere in the United States, at every institution, and especially once it becomes a standard, where you're young and you can protest and you get 100 people protesting and you close down a professor and have them leave the university, even a tenured one. This is happening. Happened at Evergreen. The teacher was a liberal teacher teaching a good class in philosophy, and yet the students felt, quote, threatened to be at the university campus, one of the safest places in the world to be, with more freedoms and more input than ever before in our history. This is how weak-willed and weak-minded and lacking in character a lot of these people are. And they're getting away with it. So now they want no tests. They said, okay, you're not going to be tested. How in the world then do you know whether a person has learned from this course? What is the purpose of going to school if a president of the United States, or excuse me, president of a university says, okay, we don't want any trouble, so you don't have to take a test. Then they said, we don't want to have to go to class. It's oppressive to us. It puts us in an unsafe environment and makes us feel threatened. Okay, you don't have to come to class. Just give us our degrees. Okay, that is exactly the road that we shouldn't be going down, because think of all the students who don't have rich parents, who work their butt off studying. They can't afford tutors. They can't afford people to take tests for them, and they didn't want that. They wanted to do it on their own, and they got into some of these Ivy League schools and better schools, and now someone comes along who doesn't have to do anything, and they can pass. How do you think that makes the other legitimate students, which I believe are the majority of students, feel? So in that respect, we should pay attention. Here's what Leo Gerard has said. The children of working stiffs learned a brutal lesson this week as federal prosecutors criminally charged rich people with buying admission to elite universities for the less than stellar children. The lesson is that no matter how hard you work, no matter how smart or talented you are, a dumb, lazy, rich kid is going to beat you. It's crucial that everyone who is not a wealthy movie star, hedge fund executive, or corporate CEO, that is, 99% of all Americans, sees this college admission scandal for what it is, a microcosm of the larger corrupt system that works against working people, squashing their chances for advancement. This system is the reason that rich people and corporations got massive tax breaks last year, while the 99% got paltry ones. It is the reason the federal minimum wage and the overtime threshold are stuck at poverty levels. It's the reason labor unions have dwindled over the past 40 years. This system is the reason we cannot have nice things, despite all the land of equal opportunity crap. The rich ensure that only they can have nice things, starting with what they can buy legally and illegally for their children, and rising through what they can buy legally and illegally from politicians who make the rules that withdraw money from the pockets of working people and deposit in the bulging bank accounts of the fabulously rich. Leo Gerard, well said. Now, I want to finish off the program today by going to Mary Holland at the United Nations, talking about how those who object or have questions about vaccines should not be pillared and attacked as they are now, or considered some dimwits. They are not. They're highly educated on the fact that something hurt their children. They want to know what. And so she's talking back. Let's hear what she has to say.
Our next presenter is Mary Holland. She's a research scholar at New York University School of Law. Ms. Holland, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here. I want to start by asking a couple simple questions to be answered by a show of hands. How many of you have ever, for any reason, been critical of the United Nations? Security Council, peacekeepers, budget issues come to mind. I see a lot of hands. Okay. And how many of you have ever been critical of the United States for any reason? Foreign policy, domestic policy, primary elections, right? So we're here at the UN, we're in the United States, but the vast majority of us have been critical of these institutions at one time or another. To me, this is like asking, are you alive? Are you breathing? Are you a thinking person? It is human and normal to be critical. Almost all of us have been critical at some point, because these are complex institutions with varying actions and inactions all the time. But now, if I ask you, have you ever been critical of your country's vaccine policies? You may be reluctant to raise your hand, and for good reason, because in the supercharged public discourse about vaccines, were you to answer, yes, I have been critical of some aspect of vaccine policy at some time, you would likely be branded anti-vaccine, that fundamentalist boogeyman term, and not by a militant or fringe publication or spokesperson. You might be branded anti-vaccine by the likes of the New York Times, the New England Journal of Medicine, the World Health Organization, and by spokespeople from National Centers for Disease Control and National Pediatric Associations. Your views on vaccines might be considered outside the mainstream and equivalent to the views of those who deny climate change. You might be considered, as I have sometimes been, a flat earther. No matter if your critiques were categorical or that you truly oppose all vaccines for all people at all times, or if you simply believe, as many people here and I do, that mercury should never be a preservative in any vaccine anywhere in the world because there are better and safer alternatives. Many in this, thank you. Many in this audience here today are branded anti-vaccine, although that is a gross distortion. We are called this primarily to marginalize and dismiss our views. But just as most of you are critical of some aspects of the UN and of the US, but think that they are important institutions, most of us have views that are nuanced, pro-health, and pro-safe, affordable, necessary, and effective vaccines, or sane vaccines. So my focus today is on the role of law in protecting human rights when it comes to vaccines. How can we balance the rights of the collective versus the rights of the individual? Vaccines, by their very nature, are a population-based medical intervention. If enough people take this medical intervention, then the so-called herd will be protected from the circulation of a communicable disease based on the theory of herd immunity. Although individuals receive vaccines, the rationale for vaccines is for the good of the individual and the society. One of the core purposes of the United Nations, set forth in Article 1 of its charter, is to achieve international cooperation in promoting and encouraging respect for human rights and for fundamental freedoms of all. So the UN and the international community have obligations to respect human rights related to vaccination. But how must nations and the UN do this? This is an important question that deserves scrutiny as it profoundly affects both individual and public health. Since World War II, the international community has recognized the grave dangers in involuntary scientific and medical experimentation on human subjects. In the aftermath of Nazi medical atrocities, the world affirmed the Nuremberg Code, which stated that the voluntary consent of human subjects is absolutely essential. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights further enshrined this prohibition against involuntary experimentation, stating, "No one shall be subjected without his free consent to medical or scientific experimentation." Such a prohibition is now universally recognized, so that some courts and scholars have pronounced the right to informed consent as a matter of customary international law. In other words, it applies everywhere, whether or not a country has it on its books. And it's the same as the norms prohibiting slavery, genocide, torture, and piracy. But what about informed consent in the area of treatment, including preventive treatments like vaccines? This is a controversial issue today in many countries, including the United States. In 2005, the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, addressed this issue, adopting the Universal Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights, based on a consensus of 193 countries, including the United States. The participating countries hoped that this declaration, like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights before it, would become a set of guiding principles. On the issue of consent, the declaration states, "Any preventive medical intervention is only to be carried out with the prior, free, and informed consent of the person concerned, based on adequate information." It further notes that the sole interest of science or society is not sufficient. This pronouncement is the extension of the medical oath attributed to Hippocrates 2,500 years ago, that doctors must work for the good of their patients and never do harm. Abbreviated as the first do no harm principle, this credo embodies the precautionary principle in medicine, clearly placing the interests of individual patients above the interests of the collective or so-called herd. This precautionary principle leads directly to the view that vaccination policies must be recommended, not coerced. The doctor-patient relationship depends first and foremost on trust, and coercion undermines it. When the doctor-patient relationship is based on coercion, trust is a casualty, and doctors then serve the state, and by extension the society, above their individual patients. This is a slippery slope where civilized medicine has too often derailed in the past. Dr. Leo Alexander, the chief U.S. medical consultant to the Nuremberg trials, warned in 1949 that from small beginnings, the values of an entire society may be subverted. He pointed out that long before Nazis came to power in Germany, a cultural shift in the medical community had, quote, already paved the way for adoption of a utilitarian, Hegelian point of view, with literature on the euthanasia and extermination of those with disabilities as early as 1931. Following the medical precautionary principle, the default position for vaccination must be recommendations, not compulsion. Individuals for themselves and their minor children should have the right to accept or refuse the preventive medical interventions based on adequate information and without coercion, such as the threat of loss of economic or educational benefits. Informed consent must be the default position because compulsion on its face not only undermines trust, but limits the fundamental rights to life, liberty, bodily integrity, informed consent, privacy, and parental decision making. Many developed countries' vaccination policies embody this principle of childhood vaccination recommendations, including conference co-sponsors Germany and Japan. Other developed countries that achieve impressive public health without resort to compulsion include the United Kingdom, Australia, Austria, Denmark, Iceland, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark, South Korea, and Spain, among others. Nonetheless, the Universal Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights does permit limitations of fundamental rights, but these limits must be imposed by law and must be, quote, for the protection of public health or the protection of the rights and freedoms of others. Furthermore, any such law needs to be consistent with international human rights law. International courts have developed a test to assess whether restrictions of fundamental rights are legitimate and lawful. The test studies whether a measure is lawful, strictly necessary, and proportionate to the risk. The state enacting the restriction bears the burden of proof that the compulsory medical intervention is lawful, strictly necessary, and proportionate. Generally, strict necessity must be the least restrictive alternative to achieve the public health objective, and non-coercive approaches must be considered first. Thus, the state must show that a less restrictive alternative is not feasible before adopting a highly restrictive or coercive one. In addition to these criteria, if a state does mandate vaccination, then it has an affirmative obligation to provide an effective remedy for those who have been injured as a result. Like all prescription drugs, vaccines carry the risk of injury and death to some. The guarantee of an effective remedy is a basic pillar of the rule of law in a democratic society, and the remedy must actually be an effective one. It can't be an illusory remedy, which in fact provides no relief.
We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening. I'm Gary Nall. I'll see you on the next program.
Ask me how I know, and I'll tell you something.